Hey everyone, welcome back to the Oval Office, where Arthur and I are going to be discussing some of politics' most influential questions looming currently in the media. From rising global tensions to shifting alliances, questions around security and foreign policy are becoming increasingly central in global politics. Today we're joined by Tobias Elwood, a senior member of Parliament and former Defence Foreign Affairs Minister, who spent years working at the heart of the UK's national security and international strategy. Tobias, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Good to see you.
So in this episode, we're going to basically explore his perspective on current global conflicts, role of Britain in the world stage, and the challenges that are facing modern defence and diplomacy currently. So the first thing I wanted to ask you, Mr. Elwood, is about your history in politics. Obviously, you have years of knowledge in defence. Could you just give us an insight into where it all started for you in a brief history of your time in Parliament?
Yeah, certainly. Before Parliament, I was in the British Army. And why did I choose the British Army? I went to university, like most graduates do after school. Wasn't sure what I wanted to actually do, but I realized after going through some big interviews, I really wasn't ready to sit in front of a desk and work. I wanted to do something a little bit more imaginative and adventurous. And I'd done Officer Training Corps, the OTC, at university. Really, really enjoyed that. And I thought, well, I see some of my friends are joining the armed forces. I had an easy line in, and why not do it for 3 years? And in the British environment, having that on your CV, you know, being in the armed forces, being an officer is no bad thing. It looks good. People, other employees enjoy having that. And it's during my time as an officer that I ask questions, you know, why are we going to this place in the world? Why is our equipment so bad? Why are we not better served by our parliamentarians and politicians? And that's when I realized and looked at the standard of decision-making, not by the MOD, by the army, but the fact that many of the things that the army has to be subject to are made by the ministers themselves, and they don't have a lot of experience when it comes to the armed forces. And that then sort of became my calling to say, well, actually, I could do as good a job as those ministers who are in charge of defense, but have never served in the armed forces. Therefore, we could get better equipment. We could get better ships. We could get better army clothing, for example, which wasn't particularly good in my time. All these big questions came up. And that's why I thought, well, let's have a plan. Let's do my time in the armed forces, get some experience, and then think about perhaps going into politics.
Right. That's really interesting. So everything kind of stems from the army and your kind of your insight into what you were seeing then in the defence side of things. And then in actual Parliament, obviously the role of an MP is an extremely stressful job, I can imagine. There's all sorts of things going on, but we just want to kind of ask about that. In your time as an MP, where did you find the most stressful situations arise?
So being an MP is a huge privilege. I served Bournemouth for 20 years, and you end up a lot of the time dealing with the constituency matters when everybody else is exhausted anywhere else to go to. So somebody is looking for a council accommodation. You know, they've been thrown off the list. They haven't been able to get what they wanted to. Parents have not been able to get their kids into the school that they were seeking. They weren't able to get the financial benefits, for example, that they were trying to claim. So you are the last resort, if you like. There's people where to go to. Oh, why don't you finally go to your MP, see whether your MP can help? And often it's the case that MPs absolutely have no power. What you have is some influence. You know, you might be able to speak to a utilities company and tell a water company not to overcharge that customer because they didn't realize that there was a leak that meant that they've got a big bill. You know, have some sympathy there. So what you're trying to do is offer another school of thought to support individuals on such a wide range of issues, of which you have very, very limited experience yourself, but you have no real power to say, make this happen or make that happen. So the times when you do get a result, the times occasionally when you're able to affect change, help somebody. They don't come too often, but when they do, they're very, very rewarding indeed.
Yeah, I can really imagine that, especially as you're talking from the position of your time as more local MP treating those kind of cases. But then moving towards into slightly higher up within your senior MP role, such as the head of defence, things like that, how important was your experience in terms of being in the army, seeing what it's like actually being a soldier in terms of delivering a proper impact as the role as leading that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it takes you from doing the constituency duties to what you do in exactly. Parliament and in government, because Parliament is actually the legislative. So they scrutinize what government's doing. And government obviously makes the decisions in all the government departments, all the Whitehall departments, including defense. And I focused on defense and security because that's the experience that I sort of brought to the table to ask questions about what we're doing, how much money we're spending on defense. Clearly, we're not spending enough. And then how is that money actually spent? We've had some crazy projects. Ajax is a great example. This is the recce vehicle that's cost billions of pounds overrun because it's not been managed correctly as a procurement project. So that's where I focus my time. Firstly, in understanding what government itself, the Ministry of Defence was doing, Army, Air Force and Navy. But then when I became a minister, so then to be responsible for it, to then actually make the decisions themselves to try and improve the support that we give our brave armed forces.
Right. And like, of course, I mean, there's so much knowledge that you have obviously accumulated from working in both defence and being the local council. So you see both sides of things. But obviously, then our other side of the show is very much about the wider aspect of kind of global politics. And some things that I wanted to ask you on that is, well, one thing that I feel like we may already know the answer to was if the UK you thought was currently doing enough to maintain its defensive capabilities in a currently very, very, very changing world, evolving world with threats coming out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, two things raised from that important question. Firstly, is what is Britain's place in the world? You know, what should we be doing at any time? And you go back through Britain's history, go back to Napoleonic times. We've always been a nation that stepped forward, perhaps when other nations have hesitated. And that comes back even before then. Henry VIII built up that Royal Navy that allows us to expand our trade and our influence around the world. It pushed forward colonialism as well. And from that stemmed a relationship with the rest of the world, which actually is perhaps different to on a different level to many other countries as well. Since in the last sort of century or so, we've been seen as a nation that makes wise decisions, that leads sensibly, that promotes democracy, and that stands up as a force for good in the world. And that, with that, is a necessity to have the hard power that sits with it. Should also explain that since the end of the Cold War, the world has looked different. You guys have grown up in a pretty benign period. You know, there's not been an awful lot of threats and so forth, the likes that we're seeing now come over the hill. And during those last two, three decades, and well, if there's no money and no requirement to spend on defense, prime ministers, governments reduce the defense budget, despite the military still wanting it, because there's no need for it. So we reduced our defense posture and in the air, land, and sea. And now we're finding that threats are increasing. Oh my goodness, we're short. We're falling short on all those areas. And then there's a sudden rush to say, well, where do we get that money from? Because the money you are saving, you know, we were spending 6%, 7% during the Cold War of our GDP on defense. Today it's down to 2.5%. That money that we're saving went to education, you know, went to health, went to our hospitals, went to schools, went to our police forces. So you spend that money. You can't suddenly start spending it again unless you make the difficult decisions about where is the money going to come from. And that's the current debate that we're now seeing in the UK. We know we need to improve the size of our army, air force, and navy. How are you going to spend it? Where are you going to get the money from?
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a really interesting point that's raised. And one of the ways we can kind of leverage into that is moving into the idea of just being a solely independent nation, into the importance of alliances, etc. And one of those characters who's definitely challenging that currently is Donald Trump, where he's recently hit out against things such as NATO, whether the USA needs to be part of NATO. How do you look out on the fact that if Trump threatens to be part of NATO, how does that affect the UK's position in terms of being a part of NATO? Do you still think we should continue to be part of it, etc.?
Well, it's certainly correct to say Trump is doing things very, very differently indeed. I mean, our relationship with America really blossomed during the Second World War. That's when the two nations really came together, worked together, and then developed this bond that said, we never want to be in this place again, where we're facing tyranny, we're facing Nazism or fascism or indeed even communism, that we're going to stand up to support the international rules-based order that was created in 1945. The United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. These are the big pillars that we call our global order. And every single American president has been absolutely committed to supporting that along with Britain. So all the UN and so forth, keeping our world safe. Now, clearly, things go wrong occasionally. Vietnam is a great example of that, where you lose sight of that, and certainly Afghanistan and Iraq. But what Donald Trump is doing is actually saying our global order is now so fragile, it's close to breaking point. But more importantly, hey, America has abided by the rules for the last 70, 80 years. But look where it's got us. We are now weaker now compared with other countries, particularly China, that doesn't play by the rules. And in Trump's book, he's saying he's got a choice, either repair the global order and get everybody to obey that, you know, to upgrade it, if you like, or say, forget that. I'm now going to join China and I'm not going to follow the rules either. I'm going to look after America. I'm going to put America first. And that is essentially what Trumpism is all about. And it goes down well with America, certainly with many in America, you know, Americans themselves, who don't have a full grasp of the international matters, who says, yeah, I'm going to support any president that's going to put my country first and stop helping other countries around the world, even Europe, that should be looking after its own defense. And that is the backdrop of which all decision-making that Trump is doing. Now, he then sees problems around the world and believes he can use his force to change things. And I think we're all now appreciating that what he's doing in Iran is arguably a step too far, because the Iranian regime is simply not going to bow, even though they've been completely pummeled from up on high. But the regime is not collapsing in the way that perhaps Donald Trump thought that his superior power would create.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that obviously Trump's word appears to be changing very rapidly every other day, if not every day. But something that I've always been wanting to pick up throughout this entire conflict that I've seen is that whilst we're seeing Trump develop into this character being very quick to move to things, very quick to create accusations, quick to blame his European partners, I'm wondering if that slightly then diminishes like these international governmental organizations such as the EU, such as the UN, NATO, things that have been vital in the Cold War to sustaining global peace. You know, factors, these organizations aren't exactly things that should be undermined at all. However, Trump is playing the card that really does undermine them. Whilst his word is changing, something that is showing it is in his actions, such as, you know, the Board of Peace clearly being some kind of substitute, as he mentioned, for the UN. Can you see that NATO and these other intergovernmental organizations are beginning to fall slightly away from the global stage and is becoming more Trumpist, is becoming more into Trump's way of Trump's, you know, his vision of these organizations instead?
Yeah, I mean, a lot to unpick there, some great stuff. Firstly, the relationship with Europe and the US. It was brought together because of the threat of communism. NATO, this alliance created to then say, we're going to prevent communism from spreading in from the east. And it did a pretty good job of that, of actually halting what the Soviets had did. You're probably aware that they gobbled up in 1956, tanks rolled into Hungary. And a decade later, they rolled into Czechoslovakia, as it then was. So you then had the Iron Curtain, all these Eastern European countries, the Baltics, Latvia, Lithuania, and so forth, and Estonia, all dominated by the Soviet bloc. And in 1991, when the Berlin Wall came down, these countries were then liberated. Russia is now rekindling that desire to have greater influence over Eastern Europe, and that's why it's charged into Ukraine. What we see from Trump now is to say, well, actually, I'm not really interested in Europe anymore. You guys are rich enough to look after yourselves. We're going to back away, not realizing that actually, if Europe is distracted by war in Europe, particularly Ukraine, if that's gobbling up all our interests and our focus, we're not able to help America if it needs help in other parts of the world. And the irony is that Trump actually sees Putin not as an enemy, but as somebody to do business with. So that's, again, a reflection of Trumpism, because he's now aware the big battle at the moment is about keeping the lights on, energy and minerals, things like that. America needs to have relationships, even with adversaries such as Russia, nuclear, for example, uranium, to keep the nuclear power going in America and to make nuclear weapons. America relies on Russia for uranium. So you can see how there's a dependence on these nations to stay friends and not allow things to get out of control. On the Board of Peace, that's a reflection, again, of what I was saying earlier, that Trump's given up on the global order as it currently stands, the UN and so forth, and he wants to set up his own group, of which he's in charge of, and gets the job for life, by the way, as well, as if that's going to solve problems around the world. Now, if the trouble is with any organization that works on consensus, including NATO, EU, or the UN, if member states don't participate 100%, it's not going to work. And the Board of Peace, you know, China hasn't signed up to it. Even Britain hasn't signed up to it. So the chance of that working, I'm afraid, isn't going to happen. But just to wrap up on Iran as well, and it's worth a bit of history there. I mean, Iran's hatred for America started in 1979, at the revolution that actually took place. And every single American president has had the challenge of dealing with an Iran that had proxy influence through terrorist organizations across the Middle East, which you'd have heard of, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, allowing to just terrorize, cause absolute huge instability across the entire region. And no American president had the strength to stand up to that. Likewise, they were building a nuclear weapon. And now you have an American president saying, I've had enough. I'm going to actually charge in there, change the system, reduce Iran's negative impact on the Middle East once and for good. I actually agree with that. What I don't agree with is the manner in which he's going around the military capabilities and the strategy. What does victory look like? And I'm not even sure Trump had any idea of what victory might look like. I think he assumed, after what he did in Venezuela and getting rid of the president there, that he could just rock up, scare Iran, and then they would then bow to whatever he requested. They've been preparing for this for a very, very long time, as we see. The regime is very resilient, decentralized, and armed to the teeth with these Shahad 136 drones, one of which ended up hitting Cyprus, our base in Cyprus, too. So it's more complicated than I'm afraid Donald Trump's bandwidth interest is able to manage. And that's usually where the special relationship comes in. It's usually where Britain turns up and says, right, we see what you're trying to do here, but why don't you do it in this particular way? You might get a better outcome. Sadly, those conversations no longer take place.
Yeah. And do you think it is necessarily still in Britain's interest just to play along with Trump's games in terms of keeping these special so-called relationships? Or do you think it's time for us to actually take this idea of independence rather than going down the completely, we'll go down an alliance route?
So wider picture, you know, we're seeing our world splintering into two spheres of influence. You've got China, the China bloc, many of the global South leaning on China simply because of how powerful economically it's become. And then you've got the West. And now the West is split between two ways as well, between what Donald Trump is doing and then what Europe and the rest of Europe is doing. And you pose an important question. normally we want to work with the American president, the American people. But Donald Trump hasn't given us a lot of options. And we've been trying our hardest to persuade him to say, stay on board, stay with us. But when he makes a play for Greenland, tries to annex Greenland, then you know really he's pursuing a very different agenda. And the irony there, by the way, is that he uses Russia as a threat to Greenland. Well, if Russia's such a threat, why not help us out in dealing with Russia and Ukraine? And he's not willing to do that as well. I just stress our relationship, that special relationship, is with the American people, with America. And it has to be able to weather any crazy American president that turns up for 4 years or 8 years.
Yeah. I mean, there's a clear big test of loyalty happening right now in every single aspect of both European side and Britain with America. But a final question that I had to ask you was that Trump obviously plays huge power politics. He really likes to give criticism when his opinion is not backed by his allies. Now, I wanted to ask, do you think that whilst Trump may have made the right move into trying to force Iran into a regime change, do you think that Starmer has played the correct move in not intervening and standing strong with his choice to not go into Iran?
So the first question you ask, if you're going to put armed forces in harm's way, is what does victory look like? And that is the question that we pose. And if you, Afghanistan and Iraq, a great example of dealing with intolerant regimes, in one case, Afghanistan, but actually attacked the United States, but not having a clear plan as to what you do if you put troops on the ground or if you start bombing from up on high. And even today, America is claiming a sort of victory, saying, oh, we've got rid of the Iranian Navy, the infrastructure is blown apart and so on. They're still able to bomb the Straits of Hormuz. And we've all learned that, 15, 20% of our oil needs that waterway access to get the Gulf nations to deliver the oil for the rest of the world to keep our lights on. And if the Straits are blocked in any way or threatened, no ship is going to be able to pass through. So it shows that Iran still has learned themselves the economic power and influence they now have. And that goes back to then the question as to what are you doing, Donald Trump? Why did you charge in there in the first place? So I think it was actually quite right for Britain to ask those difficult questions. There are many here, particularly in the right-wing media, that say, hang on a minute, we should be a loyal ally to Donald Trump. We should be standing with our best friends, America. Well, best friends also question and help and have that help guide, you know, good thought leadership, and provide some frank, concerns about where your bigger friend might be taking you. Normandy, for example, Second World War, D-Day landings. We're the ones that said, don't go to Calais. It's quite close. It's very easy. But the Germans are waiting for us. Let's go a bit further afield. It's going to be easier to land. Normandy is where we should go. And that is usually what Britain brings to the relationship. We know the Gulf very, very well indeed. One of the reasons why Iran today is so angry, or the regime is angry with Britain, is because in 1908, it was in Iran where we first found oil that was so critical that changed the entire Gulf, that made Dubai what it is today and so forth. All the oil there, it was Britain. BP, British Petroleum, was the company that found it. So we stayed in Iran for decades after 1908. In the Second World War, 1941, we then reinvaded Iran to take it over because we didn't want the Germans getting in there. And then we kept the country. We put the Shah in. We got rid of the old king that was there, put his son in, who was only 21 years old. And he was hopeless. He was decadent. He was arrogant. He did modernize the country, but he didn't look after the people. And he did it so badly that in 1979, there was a revolution by the majority of the people that supported an Ayatollah, that supported a religious fanatic cleric taking over, and they've been in charge ever since. So we have some interwoven history with the region that we also tend to forget, but we should be leaning on because it helps us understand where we might go to next and how you solve the problems that we're facing today.
Yeah, there's so much history as well behind all of these things that we speak about. There's so many examples you've obviously mentioned across the board, a list of things that have been so insightful and actually really relate. They help explain these current affairs as well, which provide context that shows their importance, how things are changing currently globally. But no, today's discussion's covered just how complex and fast-moving global politics can really be, how decisions made at the highest level have these far-reaching consequences. I think that sums it up brilliantly. So thank you so much, Mr. Elwood, for joining us today on the Oval
Office.
Thank you
very much.
Delighted indeed. Thanks very much indeed.
It's been an absolute pleasure for all your insights. And we'll see you next week on the Oval Office. Thank you very much for listening, everybody.
Thank you.